From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Time is running short in Palestine. That, according to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon Wednesday, his second day of meetings to try to defuse mounting violence between Israeli security forces and Palestinians. Speaking in Ramallah after meeting Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, the Secretary General said the UN would continue to support efforts toward a negotiated two-state solution, as Matthew Wells reports.
After meeting leading Israeli politicians on Tuesday, the Secretary General said he welcomed their assurances that the historic status quo at holy sites, revered by Muslims and Jews in Jerusalem, would remain. He stressed that ongoing settlement activity in the West Bank by Israel was illegal, but he called for all sides to denounce violence and what he called hateful discourse. Palestinian and Israeli political, community and religious leaders must stand firm against terror, violence and incitement, he added. Daily clashes between Palestinians and Israelis have left nearly 60 people dead over the past month, the majority Palestinian. Matthew Wells, United Nations.
Although the ever-expanding Israeli settlements on Palestinian land are clearly illegal, the UN Security Council has been blocked from taking any action to stop them by repeated U.S. vetoes. In just the period from 1972 to 2011, the U.S. vetoed 42 resolutions addressing Israeli violations of international law. Time is also short for the people of Puerto Rico, according to one senior Obama administration official, speaking, according to the New York Times, on a condition of anonymity, but that official is reported to have said that the situation in Puerto Rico, quote, risks turning into a humanitarian crisis as early as this winter, closed quote. According to the Times, the president is considering a plan to amend the bankruptcy laws for the island colony to create a new territorial bankruptcy regime and impose new fiscal oversight on Puerto Rico, which is running out of cash and struggling to make payments on more than $70 billion worth of debt. That plan was shared with the media late Wednesday, the same day that the island's government development bank said it walked away from the negotiating table after weeks of fruitless talks with certain creditors seeking to lower bond payments. The bank has a bond payment of about $300 million coming due on December 1st. Trouble continues to bubble in the South China Sea after the U.S. threat to challenge China's claim of territorial waters along the islands it's constructing there. CCTV's Tian Wei spoke with Senior Colonel Xiao Zhu from China's Academy of Military Science and David Langton from Johns Hopkins University about the prospects for diffusing tensions and building trust between the two nations.
The U.S. Defense Secretary, Mr. Carter, had been saying just over the past few days that the United States is ready to fly, sail, and operate in areas which he said as long as international rules allow. And of course, those areas include what China believes as its own territory. So here's the thing. One is to try to have mechanisms and principles to avoid any crisis. The other is to have tendency of actions to create crisis. So how should we understand the roles of the military in this regard?
Well, first of all, the military is responsive in both our countries, I believe, to civilian direction. So this is a political question, and the militaries are instruments of civilian control. So this isn't really a military question, this is a political question. And of course, our Secretary of Defense is a civilian, not a military person. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you started your question by saying the United States and China have different understandings. That's true in some respects, but frankly, it's not true in other respects. We'll just point out President Obama was just in Alaska, and the Chinese military sent some ships into the waters of the United States. And the United States may or may not have been happy with that, but we never challenged to the right of China to sail into those waters. And China felt free to do so. Similarly, with respect to Diaoyu Senkaku business, China challenges the claims of Japan there by penetrating from time to time, either on the sea or in the air, those lines. So I think it's really just a question. In one case, China finds the activities to be undesirable, and in other cases, it feels free to use the rules. So I think we actually understand what's going on.
All right. Senior Colonel Zhao, your analysis and also reaction to the arguments presented by Professor Lampton earlier.
The Chinese are very sensitive about U.S. military activities along its coastline. A couple of years ago, we raised the three barriers for the mirror-to-mirror relationship. One is U.S. arms sales to Taiwan, and the second, that is U.S. aircraft, reconnaissance aircraft, and the reconnaissance ships, you know, patrolling, frequently patrolling along China's coastline. And the third is your NADD 2000, which, you know, restricted 12 areas for mirror-to-mirror relationship between China and the U.S. And also from that year, according to NDAA, that year, the U.S., you know, published a China military report every year until now. Especially, you know, for the reconnaissance aircraft and the reconnaissance, you know, ships movement in this area. You know, if a country is frequently, you know, threatened by all the military activities along its coastline, and it will have a strong sense of insecurity. And so under this context, Secretary Carter declared the U.S. military is ready to patrol in 12 nautical miles of China's islands. So I think that is aggressive.
The recent fall in oil prices has tended to favor consumer nations like the U.S. and China at the expense of producers like Russia, Iran, and Venezuela. Facing down the economic pressures from the lost revenue and from speculation by domestic and foreign economic elites, President Nicolas Maduro announced a package of economic measures to combat hoarding and price speculation. The package includes new price controls that give special protections for food and medicine and penalties for those who engage in speculation, as Telesur's Cody Weddle reports.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has announced a package of economic measures to combat hoarding and price speculation. Now, this comes after Venezuela's budget for 2016 was presented, which was based on an oil price of $40 a barrel. Now, current Venezuelan oil prices are hovering just above that price.
In his weekly program, President Maduro announced reforms to the Fair Prices Law. The changes include two new kinds of price controls. One covers the whole economy and refers to a maximum price for sale to the public. The other gives special protection for food and medicines.
I'm using the powers I have under the enabling law and in line with the Fair Prices legislation. First, all products in the country should be subject to a strict maximum profit of 30% at each stage of the supply chain, as defined in existing legislation.
The president also announced new penalties for those traders who break the Fair Prices Law and engage in price speculation. Increased fines will be applied directly to the company's gross income, and in some cases, they could face prison sentences.
We are increasing the penalties, and these will now be based on a company's declared income, so that this goes to the heart of the problem. With these new measures and the existing law, we bring order to the whole prices problem. Nobody is going to cheat us from now on.
Maduro also referred to the need to regulate the world oil price, so this is set by producing countries and not by market speculators.
Let us see how the presidents and leaders of the producing countries can, from now on, regulate what we export and control the market and the setting of oil prices in this new situation we face. That is what we are proposing to both OPEC and non-OPEC countries.
He argued that oil resources should be used as a lever to promote other areas of production. and he called on all sectors to boost exports. Among the other economic measures taken, salaries for public employees in the armed forces are to go up by 30%.
A three-day event in New York begins Thursday with the aim of not only putting an end to mass incarceration of and police violence against black and brown communities in the U.S., it also seeks to take a giant stride towards the ultimate goal of fundamental change in the country. From where we spoke with Sansara Taylor, an organizer for the event called Rise Up October. We spoke with her via Skype Wednesday. Big doings in New York this weekend, including a shutdown of Rikers Island.
That's right. Rikers Island, for people who don't know, people should know, is one of the largest prison jail complexes in the world. 14,000 prisoners, human beings, are held there every night. And so as part of Rise Up October, which is 3 days of powerful political action to stop police terror, police murder, and mass incarceration, we're staging a number of events Thursday, October 22nd, Friday, October 23rd, and Saturday, October 24th. And as you said, on Friday, there's a nonviolent direct action to shut down Rikers Island and support political protest as part of that. Really, we're looking at a slow and grinding genocide. So Rise Up October is an effort that was initiated by Carl Dix and Cornel West to bring people forward and say, look, there is no neutral. If you sit on the sidelines, you're not sitting on the sidelines. You're letting the police get away with murder. You're letting black and brown people be terrorized. And we refuse to do that. We have to stand up and stop it.
So what's the schedule look like, running from Thursday through Saturday?
Yes. So Thursday, October 22nd, is the 20th anniversary of the National Day of Protest to Stop Police Brutality. And on this day, we're kicking off Rise Up October. We're bringing into the heart of Times Square, New York City, where the eyes of the world, the crossroads of the world, the families who have lost loved ones to police murder. Families are traveling from across the country. They're gathering in Times Square. And we're going to say their names. We're going to say the names of the people who've been killed by police. We're going to put a human face on this epidemic of wanton police murder. We're going to make the world see the grief and the pain and the anguish, as well as the courage and the cry for justice of these families. Never before have so many families of police murder victims all joined together in one place at one time. Usually there's protest responses to each isolated killing. But never have we come and taken the offensive and said, the world needs to see this. This must stop. So that's kicking things off. That'll be followed by a march in Brooklyn at 2 o'clock, and marches across the country for the National Day of Protest. Friday, October 23rd, is a powerful nonviolent direct action and support protest out at the Queen's entrance to Rikers Island. It's a place that's just barbaric. It is a place, 85% of the people on Rikers Island, many of whom have been held for years, have not even had a trial yet. It really is a debtor's prison. It's a torture camp. It's a place where people who can't afford bail are languish in jail for weeks, months, years without trial. And there's a deeply entrenched culture of violence and brutality from the guards. A lot of wrongful deaths and lawsuits have been paid out by the guards, by the institution of Rikers. And it's time that we put our bodies on the line to say what happens to our sisters and brothers, our sisters, our cousins, our fathers inside that prison. We need to stand up to stop it. So that's happening on Friday. And then on Saturday, people are gathering from all over the country. Buses are coming in. More of the families of police murder victims will be arriving by Saturday. We're going to have 100 families gathered, as well as clergy, religious forces, Eve Ensler, Kimberly Crenshaw, Jamal Joseph, a number of other organizations who are part of this, together with Cornel West and Carl Dix, and thousands of people. We're going to march through the streets. We're gathering at 11 a.m. in Washington Square Park. We're stepping off for a march after a short rally. We're going to snake through the heart of the city, and we're going to make New York City and the whole country and the whole world look at the fact that we are standing up to say police terror must stop. And we're going to put a challenge out to the rest of society and say, which side are you on?
So, okay, we've got 3 days and three different things we can go into. First, the murder of particularly young black and brown men in the United States. people of color generally, a legacy going back to the first quote-unquote settlers that arrived here and then brought their enslaved people from Africa here. Bernard White likes to begin his, monument, the beginning of his political education with the death of Emmett Till and everything that arose in the aftermath of that. We have those kinds of moments going back at least into the early 20th century where there was wide public awareness of cases. And yet the phenomenon seems to be accelerating, actually. And there has been, some difficulty in forcing a response out of the government that still is manifest with someone being killed every 28 hours today. You want to talk about that history some?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right to bring it up. I mean, I don't think that you can separate this epidemic of police murder, this epidemic of mass incarceration, which does disproportionately, overwhelmingly target black and brown people. I was talking about Rikers Island, and 95% of the people locked in Rikers Island are black or Latino. I mean, it's astonishing. You can't separate any of this from the fact that this country was, as you were saying, founded on slavery, the enslavement of African people who were dragged here in slave chains and then forced to work to death, to have their families sold out of their arms, to be put on the auction block, to be whipped, to be driven like beasts, to be tortured and maimed. That's what the wealth of this country has been built up on. That's what the national identity of America has always been bound up with. That and genocide and the theft of the land of the Native Americans and the killing off of Native Americans and the theft of the land of Mexico. So you can't separate what's going on today from that. You can't separate it from the whole era of Jim Crow segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror. But I think you're right in pointing to there's something intensifying now. Because on the one hand, everything that we're describing with mass incarceration, the crushing and the destruction of black and brown people's lives at phenomenal rates by the state, systematically, and always the police are acquitted, and always the victims are demonized, and always, Darren Wilson said Mike Brown looked like a demon. I mean, who says something like that? If you heard somebody talking, a Nazi talking about a Jew in that way, everybody would say, obviously, that's a Nazi mentality. But Darren Wilson was treated with reverence in the media. He was treated with reverence in the courts. You know, he was not indicted. And he said Mike Brown looked like a demon. I mean, that's white supremacy embodied. And so this has a history, but also when you're saying it's intensifying today, I think that we do see a situation where historically this country has driven and exploited black people and built its wealth on the backs of them and kept them terrorized and suppressed and oppressed. But in this era, I think that capitalism, imperialism has reached its tentacles, and U.S. capitalism, imperialism has reached its tentacles much more firmly throughout the rest of the world and is more savagely exploiting people these days in places like Bangladesh or Indonesia or other parts of the world than more profitably and more savagely than they are able to do anymore in this country. And so you have whole sections of people who they can no longer profitably exploit, who they can no longer abuse and profitably abuse in that way. So instead they have whole sections of black and Latino people penned into ghettos, denied meaningful work, denied any meaningful education or healthcare, all of this, encouraged, to live in ways that end them up, one, being profiled, and two, being locked up. And it really is a program of genocide right now. And I think this is where you see the rate of police murder today is far higher than the rate of lynchings under Jim Crow. But it serves the same role of terrorizing a whole people, but it's also, we call it a genocide because there's a program here that is actually a killing off of a people who this system can no longer exploit in the same way that they used to. And that's how I see the escalation. And I also think that in the face of an incredible resistance and rising up in the last year, things are really at a crossroads where the police, the powers that back them up, a lot of the white supremacist movements in this country and identity of the rulers has been challenged, and they're pushing back. And this is why we have to step up our struggle too, because because we don't have to accept this as permanent, but we know it won't change without struggle. And we know there's millions of people who want this to change. So this is a moment we have to seize.
And then the second day, dealing with Rikers in particular, echoes the condition of mass incarceration, where the United States has more people in prison, let alone in jail and under probation and other supervision of the criminal justice system than the rest of the world. And with only 300 million people, or 5% of the world's population, you could fairly characterize it as a police state, couldn't you?
Oh, I think it is. I think it definitely is, although I think it's selective. I mean, I think that there's huge numbers of people in this country, in this society, who go about their lives and have no awareness of, and have never been made to feel the need to be aware of, the terroristic presence of the police. You have huge sections of, I mean, majority of white people, a majority of people who live in the suburbs. So it's sort of a split society in that sense, because if you go into the projects anywhere in this country, if you go into the ghettos and the barrios, what you see is communities under occupation, communities where, you know, the majority of young men are a jacket is put on them. They're picked up. They're stopped and frisked. They're run through the system. They're, you know, you take somebody like Khalif Browder. He was a 16-year-old kid who was hanging out in the Bronx on Arthur Avenue with a friend one night a few years ago, having a, you know, summer night. And the police roll up on him. They grab him and his friend. They accuse him of stealing a backpack. He's 16 years old. They didn't produce any evidence. They didn't produce any evidence that day. They didn't produce any evidence that week. They didn't produce any evidence that year or for the next 3 years. But they took him on a few thousand dollars bail that his family could not pay. And they put him and they locked him in Rikers Island. And he was beaten by guards. He was beaten by other inmates as guards watched. He was put in solitary confinement, which is torture, for 2 years. He was a child. I mean, this is torture by every standard. And what happened to him is typical. And what they tried to do with Khalif Browder, and what it reveals about what goes on in mass incarceration across the board, is they tried to get him to plead. They tried to get him to cop a plea, and everybody thought he was crazy because he wouldn't take a plea and say he had done some crime and be released, because the crime they were accusing him of, if he had been convicted, would have caused him to spend less time behind bars than he was spending to prove his innocence. Normally, they lean on you that way. So a lot of the youth who get caught up, maybe they got caught up in some petty offense. Maybe they did nothing wrong at all, like Khalif Browder. But you spend enough time in prison, in jail, caged, in solitary, in the barbarity of these conditions, you'll cop a plea. Then you come out, you have a record. Then you're walking down the street, you get stopped and frisked again. You get picked up on some real or imagined offense. And all of a sudden, you're facing serious time upstate. You could get put away for a long time. This is what happens. And it happens only because these youth are black, because they're brown, because they come from families without money. Khalif Browder, people should know, after 3 years in the torture concentration camp that is Rikers Island, 3 years where he was, not a shred of evidence was ever produced against him. 3 years where he was never given a trial. He finally got released because they couldn't produce any evidence. They finally let him go, and he couldn't escape the trauma that he had been through. He couldn't escape it. On June 6th this year, he took his life. Now, that is on the hands of this mass incarceration. That is on the hands of Rikers. And that is just one of the many, many lives that have been crushed by what is a new Jim Crow, what is a mass and slow and grinding genocide that could become a fast one if we don't step up. And so I think, you know, this is what we're talking about when we're talking about the prison system. This is what's being enforced, and it's selective. It's in white people and people who are not as immediately affected by it. There's really a question of not being good Germans and not just going along with this.
You know, and on that point, although people with skin privilege in this country don't face that kind of oppression and haven't historically in this country, at the moment, with revelations that have come out about the government spying on all the communications of everyone practically on the planet, The conditions exist where that skin privilege could evaporate in a heartbeat. And that, to me, shows a commonality of interest that people need to wake up to.
Well, I think that's true. And I think it's important. But I also think that I think it's very crucial that we say to everybody that you need to take up this fight, in, to everybody, white people, but everybody. You need to take up this fight, not just because if you don't, it might affect you. You need to take up this fight because if you don't, you have no humanity. If you sit by while a whole people are denied any basic rights, you know, there's no rights that a police officer is bound to respect when it comes to black and brown people. If you sit by and go along with that, then you are part of a genocide. Then you have lost your humanity. And to me, yes, it is true what you're saying, and that's an important thing that people should recognize. If you don't stop this when it's coming for those who have always been locked at the bottom of society, who are demonized and criminalized and brutalized and oppressed by the system of capitalism, if you don't stand with them, yes, this system, as it increases its repressive power, it could come for you too. There is the spying, there is the culture of rape, there is the drones, and there is the destruction of the environment. All of these things are going to come for everybody eventually. And so you should take it up for that reason, but you should recognize that if you don't stand up for this on the basis that that Black Lives Matter and Brown Lives Matter, then you've forfeited your humanity. And so both those levels, I think we need to go to people on.
Yep, I agree completely. And so on Saturday, people gathering and marching. That has been done for years and years, and it has value. Of course, it's obviously got tremendous value. In terms of a response from the state, you know, the response at best has been retreat for a while and then, you know, another push forward so that we end up at the point where we are now. If you go back to the 1960s, the Civil Rights Movement, where people still found themselves in a condition where they needed to arm themselves in self-defense, those people ended up being targeted by the government, assassinated, murdered in cold blood. Driving people back into a condition where, you know, they were almost traumatized into complete submission for a period of time. What can we do to change the dynamic so that as we gather, we can make sure that we move forward and make steady progress and win?
I think it's a really important question. I like the way you posed it, because I think, first of all, we have to start from the fact that the marches have made a difference. And the struggle and resistance has made a difference, which is what you began with too. Because, yeah, you know, we look at the pushback and we look at how much ground we've lost and we look at the price that people had to pay for standing up. But if you start the story there and you don't get, the story starts when with this system is a system of exploitation and oppression, and people stood up against it and they lifted their heads and they changed themselves. And it was very liberating when they did that. And they tasted freedom and they tasted a really powerful, meaningful change. And they pushed this system back on its heels and they changed the conditions for millions of people. And it mattered. Now, what we didn't do is we didn't go all the way. In my view, we need to make a revolution. We need to get rid of the system and we need to clear it away. And we need to clear the ground to build a new system, a revolutionary society, a new state power that could actually meet the needs of the people, that could overcome the legacies of white supremacy and male supremacy, that could overcome the division between those who've been allowed to and trained to work with their minds and those who've been locked out of intellectual and mental work and forced to work with their backs if they can find work at all. We need a real revolution. That's what Revolution newspaper is writing, that I write for. That's what we're about, revcom.us. There's other people in this movement who have different analysis, and we're coming together. So I think the question of how do we actually win, how do we go all the way so that in a generation from now, people are not sitting like you were saying, and I agree with you, that what's going on today does echo Emmett Till. It does echo Dred Scott. How do we get to a place where a new generation comes up and is dealing with all of this really is history? And it's not echoing in the present anymore. I think that's going to take a revolution. I think fighting the power today and standing up and transforming the people through struggle like this outpouring is part of preparing people for that revolution.
And where can people get more information about this weekend's activities?
I would urge people to go to riseupoctober.org. That's the main site that's bringing all of these voices together. If you're on Twitter or Instagram, follow the hashtag RiseUpOctober. And then you'll see reports as the days are gathering and accumulating. Join in that, send your messages, and come out and be in the streets with us.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.